program these side loads. And there's a specific amplitude of side load that gives you maximum efficiency. 17 dB for the first and 22 dB for the second. That's the airy disk mathematics, so to speak. That's the laws of physics. You can make the side lobes stronger, and you'll have less gain. You can make the side lobes weaker, you'll have less gain. You make the side lobes those exact magic numbers, and you'll have the maximum gain. I know I'm drifting pretty far off center here, but what I'm partially getting at is that well-tuned Yagis, reasonably in length, 5 and more elements. As you start getting to 5 and more elements, the effective capture area starts becoming closer and closer to a circle. That dictates that the azimuth pattern and the elevation pattern will have strong similarity. If you saw that antenna pattern in three-dimensional space, and some of these computer modeling programs will plot the solid object three-dimensional space pattern, the main lobe looks like a cucumber, the side lobe looks like a ring around that cucumber, and then the second side lobe is a second ring, a little bit lower in amplitude. So the real three-dimensional antenna pattern is this great big cucumber of a main lobe with a bunch of rings around it. When you take the horizontal pattern, you're taking a slice through that three-dimensional object. You take the vertical pattern, you're taking a slice through that three-dimensional object. And you can take a 45-degree pattern if you want to, the conic cuts, the non-conic cuts, as they call it in the antenna world. So where you believe the antenna pattern is showing, where you believe that antenna pattern is showing you a strong difference between azimuth pattern and elevation pattern, except for the 90-degree point, I'm becoming skeptical. Now, here's what's going on at the 90-degree point. When you're 90 degrees away from the bore site of an antenna, and if it's a horizontal pattern that I'm plotting for a horizontally polarized Yagi, when I get 90 degrees out, I'm looking into the ends of each one of those elements. We all know that a dipole antenna has a null in its pattern out at the tip. In that particular direction. The real pattern of a dipole is a great big donut in space, a torus. And so the hole of the donut is in the direction of parallel to the wire of the dipole. So the dipoles themselves have a null out at 90 degrees in azimuth. And therefore, no matter how badly you tune a Yagi antenna, you will get a null in that direction in azimuth. Whereas in elevation, you're looking into those elements broadside, and therefore you will see a pattern out there. So at the 90-degree point, what I'm trying to say is that you can have a huge difference in pattern between azimuth pattern and elevation pattern. But as soon as you get away from that by 10 or 20 degrees, if, for instance, you're telling me that 45 degrees from broadside, you've got a nice side lobe in azimuth, but you've got something that's really ugly looking in elevation, if the computer program is telling you that, then I'm becoming skeptical. And I'm wondering if there's an error in the program or the error in the way the data was entered into the program, so the program didn't understand the data and came up with something that's not reality. So to sum it all up, a sharp null in the reverse direction that's 40 dB down may not be an error, and side lobes that are very different looking 90 degrees away in azimuth elevation pattern may not be an error. But when you start looking at directions that are not exactly 90 degrees away, so you're not looking into the ends of the dipole, so to speak, then horizontal pattern and vertical pattern should show strong similarity. The number of degrees away of those lobes should be very similar. If your first side lobe is 45 degrees away in azimuth, then your first side lobe in elevation is going to be somewhat close to 45 degrees away. Maybe it's 50, but it's going to be in the same neighborhood. So give me a little more description of what your computer program told you. Let's see if we can figure out what's going on. And again, give us a little bit more audio. In fact, give me a full test of a couple of words first to see if you're hitting the mic hard enough when you come back to it. And maybe it's a new rig you're using tonight, Bob. W2OSR, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. W2OSR speaking directly into the microphone. Let's see if that's any better.
You came up 5 dB. You're still a few dB low, and you're not over-modulating in the slightest. From where you are right now, you could even be shouting into that. Is that a new mic? Is it a mic that's been dropped, or is it a new rig, Bob? Go ahead.
I think the problem is that it's an old rig. It's a little bit long in the tooth. probably should be replaced with something more modern. I know the when I was on with the, in the car this afternoon, I have plenty of audio. That happens to have an exceptionally hot mic. This one is wimpy for some reason. It should be an Electrohead mic, and I'm using a dynamic on this radio because the original Electrohead didn't work too well.
Okay. By the way, almost all rigs somewhere inside have a mic gain control. So even if the rig is long in the tooth, I can't believe that the transistors in there have suddenly jumped down to a lower gain. Rarely do they ever do that. So if you get a hold of a manual, or just open up the back and look inside, there may be something labeled volume control, mic gain, or whatever. And yes, those Electret microphones do have a very high voltage output. A dynamic mic has much higher fidelity, but much lower output. So when you're using a dynamic mic, you've either got to add a preamp, or you got to find that volume control to get it up to full speed. Good, clean-sounding audio. Just wish we had a little bit more of it. So go back to your antenna pattern and tell us what you've seen so far, Bob. Go ahead.
Okay, Dick. I'm looking at the elevation pattern for the antenna. And what I'm seeing, and maybe I'm at the wrong angle off the antenna, but in any case, normally you'll see, sort of like teardrops laying on their side, coming off the antenna, especially with the dipole. This one, for some reason, it seems like the maximum radiation out of the antenna is at 70 degrees above the horizontal. Not exactly where we would like it to be. We like to have that closer to 17 degrees. That's where I'm concerned.
Okay, so are you telling me that the elevation pattern doesn't have the strongest pattern on the horizon? Assuming the antenna is aimed at the horizon, it's horizontally polarized. You're telling me that the maximum energy is not on the horizon. It is 70 degrees above the horizon on the Yagi pattern. Is that what you're telling me, Bob?
Yep, and then there are three minor lobes that are lower in elevation.
Okay, I sure wish you could mail that to me. By the way, I just went and looked at QRZ.com, and my real email address, one of many of them, is KQRIW@ARRL.net, and I've got two other email addresses. My son has also added a fairly aggressive spam eliminating program, because I do get 350 or so pieces of spam per day. Without that program, I wouldn't live long enough to be able to read anything, if you know what I mean. So occasionally, a new person who has never written to me before, the program doesn't recognize them, and they put them in the spam file, and I got to review the file and find the bad one, to find the good one, so to speak. So I get one false alarm per day, and I get one misdetection per day. But other than that, the other 350 is usually handled pretty well. And on top of that, one of the characteristics of the program is that spammers usually will send you five pieces of mail, but they send them long periods of time separated. And my son will, the way the program is set up, if a suspicious piece of spam comes in, a potential spam comes in, and if it's reissued in a short period of time, it's considered a possible real one. Whereas if somebody only reissues the mail to me once every 24 hours, that they'll stay in the spam file, if you know what I mean, if I don't find it. So don't give up. I'd like to see what you were trying to send to me. By way of ARRL, K2RIW@ARRL.net, I think it's likely to get through. And I could give you some other email addresses, but that's the one that's most easily gotten through. Another one is the spelling of my name at Suffolk.net. Suffolk.lib.ny.us. And my name with the first initial and last name spelled out, no punctuation. That's a second email address that works pretty well. So one way or another, you're going to get that to me. In fact, throughout the net tonight, I'll be checking my email, and if you manage to get it through, we'll go back to the subject. But so I think you're trying to tell me that in the azimuth pattern, the main lobe is the strongest thing, the you know, 0 degree pattern is where it's the strongest. And I think you're trying to tell me in elevation, it's not the strongest out the front, it's the strongest 70 degrees up. Now, some of these programs, when you tell the program how many feet above ground the antenna is located, and the program includes ground reflection, that could be a reality, but you and I are first tuning an antenna. Second, when the antenna is well tuned, then you want to know how it behaves in your particular reflective ground plane environment. But the antenna pattern is that which you measure in an anechoic environment. The IEEE Antennas and Propagation Society defines the performance of an antenna as that antenna performance you measure when there is no standing wave ratio. You take that out of the equation, and the performance that you measure when there's no reflections of any kind in the environment, like you put it inside of an ideal antenna chamber. So if the program has a height requirement that you have told it, then make that height requirement a zillion miles so that it can't use it, so to speak. Or try to go to the subset program which doesn't use ground reflection. You're trying to tune the antenna first, and after you've got a good tuning of the antenna, then you worry about how it performs in the presence of ground reflection. I know that sounds opposite of common sense. Common sense would say, hey, ground reflection is always present. Why can't I tune the antenna in the presence of ground reflection? And my answer to that is, don't do it. You're adding a hell of a lot more complication, and you don't get a benefit out of doing that. You just get a more complicated situation, more difficult to analyze. So is there a way you can turn off the ground reflection portion of the program, Bob? W2OSR, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, W2OSR. Yeah, I can do it in free space, which would eliminate the ground reflection. This dawned on me what I was doing wrong. I just turned the pattern 90 degrees in my hand, and now it makes sense. And if I do it that way, then my major bulb would be about 30 degrees above horizontal. How are gadgets to be working?
Yeah, but if that was a free space pattern, no self-respecting Yagi designer would call it a good Yagi design. If both the horizontal pattern, it's called the azimuth pattern, and the elevation pattern, they both must have the strongest amount of energy at 0 degrees, foresight. And the first side lobe should not be any stronger than 13 dB, and the most ideal pattern would have the first side lobe 17 dB down. Not weaker, not stronger, 17 on the nose, 17.57, I think it is, if you want to be super exact. So when you go back to telling the program you want free space pattern, and you go back to looking at azimuth pattern and elevation pattern, except for the 90 degree point, they should show a fairly strong similarity. And if not, I'd be awfully skeptical. On top of that, there are some computer programs, like the one that Paul Wade, W1 Gigahertz, Golf, who killed Zulu, has used in some of his computer modeling. He has simplified the program in such a way that it gives him easier answers, but sometimes the azimuth pattern will show a back lobe that's 20 dB down, and the elevation pattern will show a back lobe that's 15 dB down, huge differences, and they're both the exact same point in space. And so I become very skeptical when I see things like that. You can't do that, if you know what I mean. So looking forward to when you can turn off that portion of the program and make it give you free space pattern, and then you stand a chance of finding out what's going on. And I think what you also told us earlier today is that you took the most forward director and you moved it out further, where you added another director. But I believe one of the things I heard you say to Hal, I think it was, is that you moved the forward director quite a bit further forward, and you picked up 2 decibels more gain. Had you picked up another half a dB, I would have believed it. To pick up 2 decibels more gain, where 3 decibels is doubling the gain of the antenna. And just moving a director to get that much, again, I become skeptical. I think there could be an error involved. Now back to you, Bob.
Okay, well, what I'm going to do, and I'll let you get on with some of the other questions, while I go and remodel the antenna. got to wait for my computer to warm up. I'll go check it in free space, and if I have something interesting, I'll back in when we get a break in here. Okay, go on to something else, and I'll play computer antenna modeler here.
35, Bob, and come on back, because, as you know, antennas are my favorite subject, and I think it's where Mel and I can make the most good. Mel is slowly convincing the people in the high-frequency world that a simple loop antenna in the shack with him as a receiving antenna can give significantly higher performance than something that's a fraction of a mile in circumference, 40 feet in the air. Of course, that's opposite of common sense. But once you understand where the noise is coming from, where the polarization is coming from, on a signal that's been reflected from an ionosphere, once you realize the physics of what's really going on, he's not crazy, even though what he's saying sounds crazy. And he's gotten a lot of flack for that. But he's just another one of the people who have recently been discovering that an adaptable antenna, where you can steer its pattern and you can steer its polarization, and you can do that from inside the shack on a physically small antenna that's properly tuned, you can get significantly better performance than some huge array in the backyard. Hard to believe. He's discovering that over and over again. He's finding the validity for it, and he's slowly going to convince people that he's right. It's just a matter of time. I've also been running a crusade when it comes to the tuning of Yagis and where the gain is coming from and where the effective capture area is coming from, what works, what doesn't work, how bad standing wave ratio is going to bite you in the tail. Nowhere near as bad as you think. I guess I was having a quick conversation with Hal this afternoon in which he believes that standing wave ratio, and he's expressing an opinion that a lot of hams have, that when it comes to a simple dipole, standing wave ratio of 1.8 to 1 or 2 to 1 is tolerable. It gives you half a dB of loss at 2 to 1 standing wave ratio. But Hal believes, I think, if I understood him correctly, that when that dipole is the driven element for a Yagi, that it has a much more stringent requirement to fulfill, and in that environment, a 1.8 or 2 to 1 standing wave ratio is intolerable. And that's not true. When it comes to efficiency of the antenna and the realized gain, not true. And, however, in the case of a good Yagi, particularly on VHF frequencies, should you waste your time getting the standing wave ratio down to 1.05? Absolutely. And it's got nothing to do with gain. It's got nothing to do with efficiency. It's so that you can get full performance out of your low noise preamplifier. When you carefully tune a gas fed transistor to give you a quarter and a half a dB of noise figure, it only gives that performance when it sees 50.0 ohms resistive. That's a fancy way of saying a 1.0 standing wave ratio. Anything other than that, as the impedance of the antenna connected to that preamplifier, makes the preamplifier's performance degrade rapidly. If you're a serious long-range communicator on 2 meters, like these guys that do meteor scatter and moon bath and aurora scatter, and they want the best possible performance out of that preamplifier connected to the antenna, then you should follow my advice, I said here, to put forth a heroic effort to get the standing wave ratio of that particular Yagi very, very low. If you're not doing it for efficiency, you're not doing it for gain. You're doing it for noise figure of the system so the preamplifier is happy. So that's another whole crusade that I'm running. So Mel's running his crusade. I'm running my crusade. Two of us are having a tough time. We've got a very reluctant audience that's dragging their feet and throwing slings and arrows at us. Alrighty, Steve is next. KC2, Mike Delta Papa. What would you like to ask us tonight? You got it, Steve. K2RIW.
Yeah, Dick, let me make a comment first on the previous.
Go right ahead, Mel.
Okay, did he say he was running NECWIN, neck win, over?
He did say easy neck. Easy NEC is what Bob said he's running. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, because I know, I'm familiar, of course, with NECWIN, Paragon Technology, NECWIN. I've been running that for many years. And part of the program that you must observe is that they ask, they don't ask it subtly, he's got to dig a little bit for it. is what is under the antenna. Is it no ground? Are you figuring this as no ground, perfect ground, real ground, or what is known as the summer belt ground, Dick, over?
Okay. And once it asks those questions and you answer it, as the second step of using the program, I'm going to agree. By second step, I mean once you've got the antenna behaving well as an antenna, and you've got to tweak properly in free space, and then you want to find out what is that free space antenna going to do in your particular backyard, then I'm in agreement. But if on the very first step of you trying to optimize the antenna, trying to tune the antenna, trying to design the antenna, if you've got that portion of the program turned on, where the answer is being contaminated by ground reflection, and now you're not tuning an antenna, you're tuning in the antenna in the presence of ground reflection, unless you are a very smart person with a lot of experience in antenna performance and with a lot of experience knowing what the ground reflection is doing to you, unless you've got all that experience, you're going to be confused. So I'm recommending a two-step process. Make the first step, the antenna, all by itself, and optimize it. And even though common sense would lead you to believe that maybe there's a brand new optimization in the presence of ground, I doubt it. Tune the antenna first, then find out what's going to happen with ground. I wonder if you run into people with adverse opinions on that one, Mel. K2KEY, KQLIW.
Of course. What the comment is that, you're not left at the same space. What are you even wasting time for? You put it, what you see. When you do modeling with this, it could be very deceiving. Because sticking the antenna up 25, 30 feet in over what? You know, you can have a house nearby with copper gutters, with conduits or cables, you know, VX cables, the ceiling pipes, things like that. You know, when you start figuring these things and trying to plug it into this program, you're going to wind up with something that's going to throw you off. You're better off, like you said, just disconnect that. In other words, go to supposedly that is a perfect and an occasion chamber or you're in, you know, a space someplace like that. Get it that way, and then you can tweak it. Because this is where a lot of people say, the program's all wrong. How can it be this far off? I've heard this so many times, Dick, and the point is because they're figuring in something that is not realistic, over.
Okay, so to sum it all up, what Mel and I think are saying is that the ground reflection adds complication, it adds confusion, and it's not tuning the antenna. So until you know what the antenna in free space is doing, try to turn off that portion of the program. It's going to create problems. That's my firm belief on that one. Steve, KC2, Mike Delta Papa, go right ahead, KQLIW.
Good evening, Dick. Good evening to everyone else on the net. Dick, tonight I got a question concerning propagation. Recently I set up a 900 megahertz rig, and you know, getting into the local repeaters, the few that there are. And I find that at night, the repeaters come in, I say, you know, DFQ or almost DFQ. But during the day, it comes in real noisy, several days, you know, during the daytime. I could hardly hit the repeater. And at night, same repeater without moving the antenna, without doing anything, it comes in DFQ again. I wonder what's causing this, and, you know, how can I correct it? Back to you, Dick.
Hey Steve, you came to the right place. Oh, you hit one of my favorite subjects. This problem, this characteristic that you just described, unless something else funny is going on with man-made interference in the daytime, and I kind of doubt it, out of 900 megs, well, I take it back. At 900 megs, you do have a tremendous number of license-free objects. They include radio frequency identification, interrogators, readers. They include cordless telephones. They include a whole lot of garage door openers. They include a whole lot of security systems. In order for zillions of people to share the 900 megacycle region, it's called 902 to 928 megs, that license-free region, if you follow the FCC rules, part 93, I think it is, but I'm not sure about that one. Anyhow, you're allowed to run a transmitter as high as 1 watt. If and only if, every few milliseconds, it jumps to a new frequency. You must have a completely random selection of frequencies on all 50 channels between 902 and 928. You must randomly hop between all those 50 channels. In that way, you don't have two people with two cordless telephones living side by side, both being on the exact same channel, jamming each other, because each one has an independent pseudo-random selection mechanism. As for each few milliseconds, it goes to another frequency. When you listen to that with a normal receiver, you hear a little bit of extra noise in the background, but it sounds like Gaussian noise. So because people use a larger number of these license-free objects during the daytime, there's a slim chance that that is aggravating the problem. And how to prove it right now, I don't know. But just tuck that into the back of your brain as a possibility. But even if you and your buddies on 903 megacycles, we'll call it, with 903 meg repeaters, were the only thing on the planet on that frequency, even if that was true, you're going to see what I call the super refraction phenomenon. It becomes stronger and stronger as you go up to 10,000 megacycles, but when you get beyond 2 meters, you start seeing this effect. And here's what the effect is. At nighttime, on most summer days in particular, you notice that you'll see dew on the grass. You wonder, what's going on here? Well, the sun has gone down, the air is cooling, the moisture that's in the air had nowhere to go. Because the air is cooling, its ability to hold moisture decreases. Therefore, the moisture starts coming out as fog, as dew, or whatever. So you get droplets of water low to the ground at nighttime in the air mass. Up high, the air mass is much drier. And therefore, because water has a dielectric constant of 81, your aerosols of water, your small little droplets of water in the air, have a higher dielectric constant than dry air. That's a given. Higher dielectric constant means that the radio wave propagates through the more saturated air slower. So picture this now. You're standing, in the Bronx, and you've got an antenna aimed towards your QTH somewhere on Long Island, and the wave is propagating through space. A portion of the wave up high that goes to the higher air masses is experiencing dry air and moving faster. The portions of the wave that go through the lower air masses closer to the ground are experiencing the high moisture and it moves slower. You put that all together, the wave is bending downward. So nighttime air, moisture down low, dry up high, gives you a downward bending of the wave. And when the wave bends downward at the same rate of Earth's curvature, it's called super refraction. I've experienced it a zillion times. The best DX I've ever done was a guy who was running a 1-watt transmitter with his dish right at sea level on the beach at Cape Hatteras, North Carolina. I think he was 380 miles from me. 380 miles, and my Earth, even though I've got a high tower on a high piece of land, my radio horizon is 40 miles away. He was almost 10 times my radio horizon line of sight. My line of sight horizon. 10 times further away. That guy, because of the super refraction that occurred at nighttime, that signal sounded to me like it was in my backyard. He was 60 decibels over my noise, running a peanut whistle, 1-watt transmitter, 380 miles away. And you could do that day in and day out. It's not a rare condition. So at nighttime, you're going to get super refraction. So is it the super refraction making the signal stronger at night? Absolutely. Is it the extra noise from all of these license-free objects being used in the daytime making the noise higher? Absolutely. And in the daytime, when the sun is shining on the ground, the air mixes together in all kinds of ways, and you don't get this layering where you get moist air down low and dry air up high. In fact, there are a few occasions in the daytime where the moisture is in the clouds, it's up high, and down low the air is dry, and you can get sub-refraction where the wave is being bent upward. And therefore, you could be standing, you and your buddy are on two mountains, 30 miles apart. You take out your telescope, you can see him standing on the other mountain, optically. The telescope says, there he is. I see him waving at me. He's talking over the repeater, and I can hear him. but I send the signal directly in his direction, and he doesn't hear it. And you say to yourself, what in the world is going on here? I'm optically looking at that man. I have line of sight. I send him the radio signal, and he's not getting it. Because of subrefraction, the radio wave can be bending upward, and that happens. And, of course, it's hard to explain when you see it. You're going to accuse him of having a dead receiver, and he's going to accuse you of having a transmitter that's not on the air, if you know what I mean. We've been down that road a few times. Maybe this helps a little bit, Steve. KC2MDP. And by the way, propagation is one of the fun things to study. As you go up higher in frequency, you're going to see other phenomena. Just wait till you start reflecting signals off of rain clouds and off of mountains and off of buildings and off of bridges on these upper frequencies. It comes fun stuff. KC2MDP, K2RIW.
K2TV.
Okay, somebody else signed in. We had a double, but let Steve first talk, and then we'll pick you up. Go ahead, Steve.
Okay, thank you very much, Dick. Great explanation, as usual. Yeah, that would make sense because, I've aimed my beam at several different repeaters, and like I said, at nighttime it's almost EF2, and during the day, three or four repeaters are uncopyable, or, that signal sounds awful. So that sounds like a very good, very, very good possibility, and I'll have to experiment a little bit more with it. Once again, Dick, thanks for the explanation.
One other thing, Steve, when you aim your beam at these repeaters, because the beams of the repeaters are probably vertically polarized, is your beam vertically polarized? The reason I'm asking that is, even if you're using a horizontal polarized beam, common sense would say, gee, it ain't going to work, don't even try. Don't give up so easily. I've often used a purely horizontally polarized Yagi, and I've aimed it at vertically polarized repeaters, and worked very well. But the main lobe is a little bit peculiar. It's the strongest signal is in a slightly different direction, 5 or 10 degrees off to one side. On top of that, what you're listening to right now, my current 14-element Yagi, on top of my 100-foot tower, is tilted at a 45-degree angle in polarization. I'm halfway between the horizontally polarized sideband people and the vertically polarized repeater people, and I check a 3 dB hit to do that. So your particular beam that you're aiming, what is the polarization on it, Steve?
It's vertically polarized, Dick. That's another question I was going to ask you, because I know you had mentioned several times about the Faraday rotation. Is that a possibility, and do you think it would help if I put it on slant 45, or maybe one day I'll get lucky and then the next day I'll get nothing? Back to you, Dick.
In your case, I do not recommend you do that. When it comes to Faraday rotation, and when it comes to ionospheric reflected signals, I use the word reflection in quotes because it's more complicated than the simple reflection, but we'll call it that. When a signal goes through the plasma layer called ionosphere, which is a mixture of a conducting medium called ionosphere plus magnetic field created by the Earth's magnetic field, that combination gives you Faraday rotation. Faraday rotation decreases as 1 over frequency squared or 1 over frequency cubed. I keep forgetting that. As you go to higher and higher frequencies, the Faraday rotation gets small real fast. And 900 megacycles, I think I can say very close to 100% of the time, you will never be using the ionosphere on 900 megacycles. I think the highest frequency where the ionosphere gives you a reflection is somewhere around 220 to 400 megacycles. You just don't get intense enough ionization to get a reflection as you go up in frequency. So it isn't Faraday in your case. And this super refraction phenomenon, when you get the moist air down low and you get the bending of the waves, that is not a plasma. That is it's not an ionosphere. It does not have Faraday rotation. Only the plasma of the ionosphere, up much higher in altitude, 50 kilometer type stuff, but that's where Faraday rotation can take place. So I think you're not seeing Faraday. Now, should you have polarization agility in your antenna? Should you have an antenna that's got horizontal, vertical, and slant 45? That's strictly a function of who you talk to. If you suddenly develop a love for the sideband people on 900 meg, and they're running horizontal, and you also want to talk to repeater people and they're running vertical, then it would maybe be worth considering, because 900 meg antennas are so nice and small, taking an alliance rotator, putting it in the middle of the boom, so that you dial your Alliance rotator and rotate the antenna in polarization, where you can rotate it from horizontal to vertical and everything in between. That would be a fun project. Unless you think there's a lot of sideband people out there at 902 to talk to, right now I don't recommend the 45-degree polarization approach for you. Back to you for any clarification on that, Bob, before I pick up the person who wants to make a comment on this. KC2MVP, KQRIW in the tech band.
Very good, Dick. Yeah, there's very few repeaters even to talk to on 902.
In other words, in the winter months, I should see a difference. Do you think I'll see a difference with the, you know, the less humidity and stuff in the air? Dick, back to you.
Yes. The super refraction phenomenon definitely decreases in the number of occurrences in the wintertime for a whole bunch of reasons. The air becomes much drier on a 20-degree Fahrenheit winter day. You still get a little bit of it, but it's nowhere near as noticeable in the winter. Then again, I've run 10 gigahertz operation for about a four-year solid period for summer, winter, spring, and fall. And we got some beautiful propagation off of snow clouds and rain clouds in the wintertime. So don't give up just because winter comes. And 900 megs, the really progressive people, the move up in frequency, and you're becoming one of them. On top of that, keep your eye out to eBay. You will find a tremendous number of extremely expensive transistorized amplifiers are being dumped at ridiculously cheap prices on eBay. I'm talking about the ELPA series of amplifiers, ELPA. Extremely large power amplifiers is what I think it stands for. They come in 600 watt, 300 watt, and 150 watt denominations. Because of the change in standards and the changes in the hardware, these amplifiers that used to cost $5,000 and $10,000 a piece are being sold on eBay for $150. It's 20 pounds of hardware, the 600 watt amplifier version. I own a few of these things. Beautiful pieces of hardware. Extremely well designed. Very high linearity, very complicated amplifiers. The slight disadvantage is they run on 26 volts, 24 volts, anywhere in that neighborhood. It's not a 12-volt amplifier. But 600 watts with nearly 60 decibels of gain. You put plus 10 dBm into that amplifier, which is 10 milliwatts, and out comes 600 watts. It's got built-in heat sinks, fans, protection circuits. It's a moose of an amplifier. 20 pounds with a carrying handle. It's a package that's about 2 inches high. I'm guessing it's around 10 or 12 inches wide and about 18 inches deep. And it's bad, an amplifier. It's $5,000 or $10,000 worth of hardware for $100 or $200 if you can find the right source for them on eBay. If you think you're going to run high power, sideband, long range operation on 900 megs and consider it, the band's going to increase in popularity. Latch on to some of these amplifiers. In my opinion, the price is right. And when it comes to converting them, for their normal service was 880 megacycles. To move it to 900 megs requires almost nothing. In fact, the majority of what the conversion consists of is removing all of the super linearity circuits. So you get a little bit more power output, and the linearity is all carefully tuned for 800 meg operation. You don't want to go through the rigmarole of trying to make that kind of super linearity at 902. You don't need it. So you're going to take out the one-third of all the hardware that's in there, and what's left is some really beautiful Motorola high-power transistors with beautiful heat sinks and a very nice layout, and you could throw that amplifier down a flight of stairs 10 times, and it'll keep right on playing. It is rugged. So I wonder if that made some sense of the KC2MVP, KQLIW.
Yeah, it's funny you should mention that, Dick. I was on eBay, as a matter of fact, the other night, looking at some of these things. Yeah, they're very cheap. You know, like you said, $125, $150, you know, for, like you said, a 600 watt amp. You gave me a great idea. That might make a fun project for the cold winter days coming up ahead, Dick. Once again, I thank you for the explanation. Thank you.
Yeah. Right now, you could think it's a problem that the 902 meg band is so low in activity and low in occupation of ham radio operators. Another way of looking at it, it is 26 megacycles of width of frequency spectrum that is dedicated strictly to you that you can do anything with it. 26 megacycles wide ham radio band in which you're allowed 1,500 watts peak envelope power. And by way of those LPA amplifiers that are inexpensive, and boy, they will heat up a piece of coax like you wouldn't believe, they've got power. You can have a lot of fun with that band and develop your own private radio network for you, your family, and your buddies if you want to. It's the wide open spaces, except for the little bit of grief you're going to get in metropolitan areas during daytime operation. You're going to have a little bit of accelerated noise because of these other license-free frequency hopping things that are there. And I think that difference is, it's a couple of dB of difference in sensitivity, if you ask me. Unless you live right next door to somebody that's using it to, that piece of equipment 24 hours a day, I don't think you're going to get much of a problem. There's another person who wanted to make comments on all of the above. Give me your call letters again, sir.
Kilo 2 Tango Victor.
Kilo 2 Tango Victor. Start up with your name, sir, and then your comments.
Okay, his name here is Bob. And just a little information on 902. The new band plan for repeaters that was instituted by MetroCorp earlier this year avoids or tries to avoid a lot of those RFID frequencies and the unlicensed telephone frequencies. Because unfortunately, some of those pieces of equipment are not exactly accurate, and some of them are very broadband too. But they, if the repeaters he's trying to use are coordinated repeaters, hopefully they have avoided those frequencies that have been used by the unlicensed services. So the band plan was carefully laid out for the repeaters by MetroCorp to avoid that problem. And there'll be a lot of, apparently there's a lot of 900 megahertz FM equipment becoming available, some of it on eBay, that can be readily converted to the band very easily, actually just by reprogramming. But I think that the refraction product that he's seeing, K2RAW, K2TV.
Very fine, Bob, and thank you for the information. Now, MetroCorp is assigning band plan frequencies for their repeaters in such a way to avoid the license-free frequency hopping items. I'm wondering how they do that. In other words, there are 50 channels, so to speak, that have to all be used in a pseudo-random manner. Are they trying to assign the frequencies midway between those channels? Is that what they're trying to do? Bob, go ahead.
Basically, yes. They're just avoiding. Now, apparently, some of them may not work that way, but apparently the areas that the frequencies, and I'm in the mobile now and I can't tell you which frequencies are available. I don't have it in front of me. But when they were laid out, apparently that was taken into account. And so most, if not, well, I shouldn't say all, because with those devices, you can't be sure. One of the problems is a lot of them are very broadband to begin with, and some of them are not very frequency stable, the unlicensed devices. So basically, they try to avoid by going in between. It also turned out that the frequencies being used lend themselves to be easily converted, or equipment for it can be easily converted for the frequencies that the repeaters land on. There's also some sideband and CW and experimental work done on the band too. There's not many people, but our understanding is that there are some people that that are apparently on that band. So the low signal level group is there and active. I don't have any specific calls, but I do know there is some activity on the band. And that was taken into account also, avoiding those portions of the spectrum. K2RAW, K2TV.
Very fine, and thank you for the additional information, Bob. The more I think about it, one of the things you just said reminded me of the fact that the frequency hopping units that are allowed to be by the FCC rule, Part 93, I think it is, on the license free band 902 to 928 megs, are allowed to run as high as 1 watt of real transmitter power. They're allowed to use gain of the antenna up to and including 6.0 dB over isotropic. You put it all together, it means that your effective radiated power on this license free band is allowed to be up to but no more than 4 watts. So if you're 4 watts and down, you must be frequency hopping on all 50 channels. The design of the equipment must do that every few milliseconds. However, I think there's another subset to the rules where if you're running an extremely small amount of power, I don't remember the exact number, but maybe it's something like a milliwatt or so. If you're running a milliwatt or so, and some of these cordless phones may fall into that category because you're only trying to go a couple of rooms away in your house, there they're allowed to be on a fixed channel, not frequency hopping. So I think there are some frequencies on the 902 to 928 meg band that are set aside for low power, fixed frequency, license free objects. And I think you're saying MetroCore has intentionally avoided those and tried to position the frequencies in between the frequencies of the 50 hopping channels, and also avoid the what the hams typically do, and that is, if the hams call it the 903 band, probably 903 to 903.1 is dedicated as CW, 903.1 is probably dedicated as the calling frequency, and then sideband occurs above that, above the 903.1. Is that approximately the way it was set up to your knowledge, Bob, at K2 Tango Victor, Mobile, K2RIW?
Yeah, that's a good approximation. I don't have the exact band plan. Again, I'm in the Mobile here. I'm just on the way back home from a long ride from Virginia. But, yes, it was set aside. It's approximately what it is. The exact frequencies, I don't know. But there is room for everyone on it. And that is, as you said, a huge band. There's plenty of frequency spectrum available. And it lends itself, it's a very interesting band also, both propagation-wise and from just experimenting with equipment. And the antennas, I might add. The antennas are really small, so you really don't need a... it's not like working with a 10-meter antenna or a 6-meter antenna. They're relatively small, as you know. And it's a very interesting band, very interesting propagation characteristics, too.
Absolutely. Because the frequencies go from 902 to 928, and I do design on those frequencies on a daily basis for my salt mine, so to speak, the center of the band is 915. 915 has a wavelength of 12.9 inches. So the 903 band, as we amateurs call it, has a wavelength of approximately 12.9 inches. A half-wave dipole is approximately 6 inches long. If you build a Yagi on that band, each of the elements of the Yagi are in the vicinity of 6 inches long, and the spacing between the elements is an inch and a half, 2 inches. If you go to the website of Kent Britain, Whiskey Alpha 5 Victor Juliet Bravo, Whiskey Alpha 5 Victor Juliet Bravo, .com. You go to Kent Britain's website, you'll see these beautiful printed circuit Yagi antennas. I've got in use right now, occupationally, 30 or 25 of those printed circuit antennas in use with what I do at my salt mine. Beautiful antennas. They only cost a few dollars. You install a little bit of a connector on the edge of the printed circuit board. It's got 6.0 dB of gain over isotropic. Beautiful antenna pattern. About 85 degree main load beamwidth. No. Less than that. I think it's right. Total main load beamwidth, I think, is something around 85 degrees, 60 degrees. I keep forgetting the numbers, but it's got 60 dB of gain, reasonable front-to-back ratio, inexpensive. If you wanted to build a really high-gain, rotatable antenna, one possible approach would be to take a handful of those printed circuit Yagi antennas. Each one of them is about 6 inches wide, about 4 inches front-to-back, and a 16th of an inch thick. A nice green printed circuit board with a gold-plated contact on it. Very nicely built antenna. So you go to his website, you buy those antennas, you put together an array of them fed with semi-rigid coax cable, and you can make yourself a great big phased array antenna with 15 or 20 dB of gain rather easily. And so have a lot of fun with that band, as I see it. The whole darn antenna would weigh a couple of pounds. It wouldn't cost you a very large amount of money. The antennas are so nicely built, you wouldn't even waste your time home brewing them, so to speak. You write a check, the problem goes away, and you got the antennas in your hand. It's an approach worth considering. I've done that. Not as a phased array. I just needed a whole lot of antennas on that frequency band to do a bunch of experiments, and they happened to be Kent Britton's antennas. Okay, the next person on our list was Mr. PNJ. He said no. Mr. RPE, I think Don said yes. KC2 Romeo Papa Echo, you did or did not have a question for us, Don? Go right ahead.
Yeah, name is Dave. Yeah, I do. I've got a HF belt right here in the apartment, and I've got a long wire in the attic. And I'm trying to get that radiation as much up and out of the building as possible.